Hello, and thank you once again for joining me on The Runtime. I'm your host, Raphael Kennedy, and this is the podcast where we go deep into software design. Before we get started, I wanted to introduce my guest, Firas Abukadije. Firas is the author and maintainer of WebTorrent, StandardJS, and hundreds of other open source projects. His software is downloaded more than 500 million times a month. He was a lecturer at Stanford, where he created a course, CS253 Web Standards, and he's joining me to talk about a project called wormhole.app. It's a way to quickly and securely share large files. This is actually the tool that I've been using to share the advanced recordings of this show with my guests, so I was really excited to talk to him about it. Welcome, Firas, and thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Yeah, awesome to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So before we actually get started, would you mind giving us an overview of Wormhole and what makes it different from the ways listeners are already circumventing their email attachment size limits?
Yeah, sure. So the goal with Wormhole was to build a way to send files across the internet that is fast and totally secure. So one of the ways that we do that is we have end-to-end encryption. So that means that we generate a key in your browser, and that's used to encrypt all the files that you send through Wormhole. And that's never shared with the server. So the server never sees the key, which means that the server can't see your files or learn anything about what you're using Wormhole for. And that's like one of the main differences, and the other is, again, speed. And with Wormhole, we tried really hard to make everything about using it faster than other file sending services. So what you'll notice if you use Wormhole is you just drop the files on the page and we give you a link within a second or two. And you can go ahead and copy that link and paste it into your email or to your chat app or whatever you're using to share this link. And you can go ahead and send it right away, even before the files that you're sharing have finished uploading to Wormhole. And that makes it really fast to just sort of jump over to Wormhole, get the link, and then move on with your life. And you don't have to sit there waiting for the files to finish uploading before you can get on with whatever you're doing. And so the files can just sit there uploading in the background and finishing up later on. And the other thing, I guess there's a third thing that we do that's kind of different is we try to make it so that the downloader can also start downloading right away. And that's done with some streaming technology that I guess we're going to get into a little bit later. But what it means is basically that the downloader can actually start to download the files before you've even finished uploading them. So that means that it's it's fast all around. As many ways as we could think of, we tried to sort of inject little bits of speed into the design of it.
Yeah. So, do you mind telling us like a little bit more about what's going on under the hood? The whole process starts when you drag a file from your desktop onto a drop target on the web page. What happens next?
Yeah, so a whole bunch of things happen. I guess I'll start with the encryption works, because I think that's probably the most interesting. Well, actually, fundamentally, one thing to mention really quickly is that, like, whenever you're dealing with large files, where users can give you files that are, up to, I guess in the case of Wormhole, we support 10 gigabytes. You have to keep in mind that, like, you can't really operate on the files as an array in memory or as a buffer in memory. You have to, like, everything has to be done with streaming, which means that you read out a piece of the file at a time and you process it as you go. And so we have this sort of this pipeline set up. So when you've selected the files you want to share, the first thing we do is like pipe them through an encryption stream that encrypts the data. And that's all encrypted with a key that's generated in your browser. And we use the Web Crypto API to generate a secure key,
So you say you're piping that through that pipeline, that's happening in the client?
Mm-hmm. In the client, yeah, exactly. Yep. So it's all happening in your browser, and then the output of that is this encrypted data, and we do that per file. So every file is encrypted separately, and then we take the output of that and put it into a torrent. Torrents are just, if you're familiar with BitTorrent and the way that whole thing works, there's sort of this idea of a torrent file which is basically a metadata file. It's a file that kind of tells you about the files that you actually are interested in. So if you open up that torrent file, what you'll find inside is really a list of file names and then hashes for the data that makes up those files. And this is really useful in the context of a system like BitTorrent, because you're often getting the file data from peers that you don't necessarily trust. But if you have this torrent file in advance and that you know is, you know, that is the metadata for the file that you're actually looking for, then it doesn't really matter where you get the file data from, because you'll be able to get data from peers and then hash it and compare it to the hashes in the metadata file. And if they match, then you know for sure that the files that these peers gave you are correct. And so we do that because, like I mentioned, Wormhole does have a peer-to-peer component where you are getting pieces of the data from other from other people in the system. So the uploader is a peer and the downloader is a peer, and any other downloaders that are on the page are also peers. So we actually do like sort of full BitTorrent swarming with Wormhole. So everyone who's trying to download that same set of files are fully connected to each other like they would be in a BitTorrent system. So we do that, and then we take this torrent file and then encrypt that with the same key, and then upload that to the server. And then we also take the encrypted files and upload them to the server as well. And what that lets us do is when downloaders show up to download, they're able to download this encrypted torrent, decrypt it with the key that they've been given by the sender, and then they now can see the actual metadata for the files that they're about to get. They can show the list of file names to the end user, and then they can attempt to get them with peer-to-peer, by connecting to the sender or to the other downloaders that may have pieces of the file. But if no one is online, if the sender has already closed their computer, then they can fall back to getting the data from our servers, which is holding on to the encrypted versions of those files. The downloader basically downloads those from either peers or from the server, and then they can decrypt the resulting files. And then, that's kind of the high level end to end of how it works.
Very cool. And you elided a bit, but how does that key get passed around, the encryption key?
Yeah. So we put the encryption key directly into the URL that the sender gives to the people that they want to access the file. And we put it in this part of the URL called the fragment identifier, which is the hash symbol that you may have seen in certain URLs. And that hash symbol is significant because it's the one part of the URL that doesn't get sent to the server, which is really useful for our purposes, because we basically want to have a URL where the sender can share it with somebody, but then when the downloader goes to actually visit that URL, we don't want their browser to make an HTTP request to the server that just reveals the secret key to us, because we're trying really hard to not get this key. We don't want to see the key. We don't want to know what's going on in your files. So the fragment identifier is super useful for that. It means that we can basically put the key there, and then the browser chops that part off before it makes the HTTP request. And then what it typically will do is when it gets the resulting page, it actually will look for an ID, an element in the page with an ID that matches that fragment identifier, and it will scroll you to that part of the page. But in our case, that's not going to match anything because it's a random key. And so so it doesn't actually serve that purpose of sort of scrolling you to the right part of the page, which is what the fragment identifier was originally designed for. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's those like anchor links, essentially, that you're using for that. And so that makes sense. Yep. Because you then get a pretty easy way to share, the file and the encryption key at the same time, because you've got one URL. You don't have to like Slack someone a password or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The link is the password in this case. Yep. Yeah. Although we've actually had some users ask for the ability to add an additional password, which I totally get, because there's actually a use case that one question, not to go off on a tangent, but just real quickly, there's some people will say like, why is Wormhole better than just sending these files in an email? Because if I include the Wormhole link in the email, then can't anyone with access to my email just click the link and get the files? And on the surface, that sounds like a really good argument, but like the difference is that, first of all, you don't have the files sitting in someone's inbox forever, because the Wormhole link expires after 24 hours. So you don't have this sort of plain text of whatever sensitive files you're sending just kind of sitting in someone else's email for all of eternity. And you don't have to hope that like they're not going to get hacked one day and then that data becomes public. So that's the first reason. And also that's exacerbated by the fact that like Gmail by default just doesn't, doesn't delete stuff ever. Most people don't delete stuff anymore. They just archive or they just let it sit in the inbox. So you really are trusting the security of the email provider, of the user's local device, or of, that user's password management practices, so that you're just basically hoping that data will be securely held indefinitely in that person's inbox forever. So using Wormhole gives you a little bit more of like a Snapchat model where like, okay, the default is the data gets deleted instead of the default is the data sits around forever. So the second reason is that the email provider can't, automatically scan the contents of the files or basically do things with the files that you wouldn't approve of. So whether that's some employee at the company, deciding to dig through and like look at the stuff that's in there, or an illegal government request for the files or something like that. With Wormhole Link, they could do that, but like chances are that those things happen like long after the file has already expired. And it goes from being a more of a passive attack to a much more active attack. Like someone who's just like, looking through emails for keywords or something like that, unless they implement custom support for like clicking wormhole links as they see them come through and like downloading those files for further analysis or something, it's not going to be caught up in that as easily. So it's just like a kind of yet another reason that you get an advantage of using Wormhole. But I guess the way to kind of get around, like the kind of way to get sort of total security and not even have to like worry about the person who has the email, like getting the link is you can sort of imagine adding another password on top of that you deliver to the recipient out of band. Like you call them on the phone or you use another chat application to give them the password. And then
whisper it in their ear in person.
Yeah. Or a carrier pigeon or something. Yeah. And then you have sort of now the email by itself with the link is not sufficient to access the files. So that is a use case that like would be nice to support, but you still get a lot of benefit just from doing it, doing just the link.
Yeah. I imagine a thing that you also would eventually need to think about is accommodating people's need to feel like their data is secure. That there's a confidence that comes in typing a password into a box. That... Yeah, that's interesting. So you mentioned you've talked a lot about speed and end-to-end encryption. Was there like a single, top priority that you were looking at as you were building this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think we knew that we could do end-to-end encryption at least to the level that Firefox Send did it. And that was like the product that, Mozilla started a few years ago that we were really inspired by. Unfortunately, it's shut down now. So Wormhole is basically designed to be the replacement to Firefox Send. So we knew that like the end-to-end encryption could be done in a way that's, reasonably performant and like secure with the same threat model that Firefox Send had in mind. So the question was really like, how can we make the user experience better or the speed better? That was what our focus was, with the assumption that like we take it as a given that we're going to not compromise in any way on the end-to-end security. So I would say like they were both UX and end-to-end security were our top priorities, but we kind of knew that like, okay, we can do the end-to-end encryption like part of it. That's a given. So then the challenge was like, how do we improve upon the like file sending experience? And that all just comes down to like reducing clicks, improving speed, and offering like different ways to get the files to people. So we have like a QR code thing that you can scan. We have, we support like the native browser sort of share menu thing. We have like one click to copy the link. We do the thing where you can copy it before it's uploaded or before it's finished encrypting and things like that. So, and we integrate with like the Android operating system, so you can like add it to your home screen and it's like a full PWA, progressive web app. We just tried to do like basically every possible integration point to make it easy to like use and to reduce steps. Even something like configuring like how many downloads of the file you want to allow, that's a thing that like we support. So you can say, I want this file to expire after one download or after 100 downloads or after, 1 hour or after 24 hours. But we don't make you make that decision before we give you the link. So we do that, we like move that to after the link is generated. It's like little things like that don't seem like a big deal, but yeah, I personally think that little stuff is actually pretty important for how people perceive, what it's like to use the app. So we just tried really hard to do all that little stuff right. It's not perfect, but like we did our best.
Yeah, I will say sometimes those things that if you had asked me ahead of time if it mattered, I would have said, of course not. But if it lets you finish sending your email before you start thinking about the next thing that you're doing, you know, if it lets you improve your order of operations, it actually helps more than you would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually one of my pet peeves at the Dropbox, was that that's like you have to basically put your files in there and wait for them to fully upload before you can even right click and get a share link, which means like whatever you were doing is like halted for like potentially hours, depending on how big the file is. And then finally it finishes, then you get the link and then you put it in the email or whatever you were doing. And it's sort of like, it's just disjointing your like workflow into these stages. And it's just like, we have computers, like computers should make our lives easier. They should just do this for us. Like we shouldn't have to manually sequence things like that.
Yeah. So this project uses a bunch of technologies like WebTorrent that I associate with you, I think rightly. So I was wondering as when I saw that you were building this, if this was like a project that started with a customer need, or if it started with, you know, technologies that you had access to and you were looking for sort of a cool way to leverage.
Yeah, I think it started with a need. So I mean we like felt bad that Firefox Send was shut down and we wanted a replacement that we could trust. And there are like, you know, random apps out there that let you send files in your browser, but none of them felt like they were done with the level of rigor that would make me want to personally send my files through it. And so I think, yeah, we just started with like trying to basically make the most trustworthy replacement that we could make. And the technology kind of followed from there. So, you know, we used WebTorrent because we thought that we thought it would allow us to provide these additional enhancements, like being able to stream before the upload is completed. And using it was nice because there's already been like years of work that have gone into that library, and we know how it works. And so we were able to, you know, configure it in a nice way where it gave us exactly the properties that we wanted. But to be honest, it's not like a perfect fit for Wormhole.
Why not?
Because it has so torrents have this design thing where they're basically immutable. So the set of files that you choose at the time that you create the torrent is sort of baked into the torrent file, and it doesn't. I mean, there are some people have extended the spec to support mutability, but it's not really what it's meant for. It's not really what it excels at. So like what that means is basically if you create a wormhole share link, and you put like 5 gigs of files in there, and then you decide you want to just add like a little tiny extra file that you forgot to add the first time around, we have to regenerate the entire torrent file, which means we need access to all the files again, and we have to rehash everything and re-encrypt everything, which, you know, we could solve this by maybe making like a second torrent and then making the display that you see on Wormhole be like the merging of the two torrents, and you see the merged file list or something like that. But it would be much, much nicer if the system just like had a way to just add a file to it or delete a file. And so, you know, we could support kind of modifying the state of we call it a room, but it's basically a folder of files that is mapped to a URL that you can share. So that is sort of immutable once it's created right now. And that's basically because of the design of torrents. So yeah, I mean, if we were going to like, you know, really optimize this even further, which, you know, we probably will get to eventually, we will probably end up like basically forking WebTorrent and then modifying the protocol or maybe even rewriting something from scratch that just like does exactly what we want and doesn't have even like any extra stuff or any decisions that aren't perfectly suited for the use case. But for this V1, it totally works fine. It's just, there's some UX things that we could probably improve if we made it custom.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
Did you consider, you know, other similar things like IPFS or, I don't know, other sort of peer-to-peer communication patterns?
Mm. Yeah, we looked at the HyperCore stuff, so HyperDrive, which is, you know, also known as DAT in the past. And so I'm a little bit less familiar with that than WebTorrent, so I wasn't able to figure out how to use it in a way that doesn't save kind of a permanent log of every change you make to the room. So like if you delete files from a room, you don't want the record of that to stick around like it would in your Git history. If you delete a file, it's sort of forever in the Git history. We wanted to support like yeah, like a way to kind of, we don't really need a full log history, which is what that design gives you. We need something a little different. So I mean, there might be a way to use it in this configuration, but I was like less familiar with it, and we couldn't figure it out in a quick enough time. So we were just like, okay, screw it, we're just gonna use WebTorrent.
Yeah.
The other thing too is like we are interacting with a bit of traditional web infrastructure in a way that WebTorrent is nicely suited for. So one thing we do is, like we mentioned, we upload your files to the cloud, and we're using Backblaze for that. So they receive a copy of the end-to-end encrypted files. And we do that with like just normal HTTP. And the torrent protocol has this nice support for this thing called web seeding, which is basically a way to have a peer that is just a server. And so you can like treat it as a peer so if there's like no other peers that have the file data that you want, you can just be like, oh, I'm going to get it from the web seed, which is just a server, but you can kind of ask it for the part that you want using an HTTP arrange request. And then, you know, it'll just, as far as the torrent protocol is concerned, it's just like any other peer, even though it's backed by a server. And so that was nice that was kind of they're out of the box with torrents. Maybe Hypercore has that as well. I just was, like I said, less familiar. So reached for the tool that, you know, I have the most confidence with.
Fair enough. So you talked about, you know, a couple of the trade-offs associated with the choice of WebTorrent. Are there other choices you made that, you know, that involved that kind of give and take?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's all kinds of things. Like we decided to support, you know, Safari on iOS, which is it was a really difficult decision because it just, yeah, it takes a lot of time to support. It's not the best browser. Or we could do a design where we could have basically gone without the whole peer-to-peer approach. And then in a lot of ways, like things would have been way simpler. Like one of the main challenges we ended up facing that we didn't expect was web storage, like is pretty different across browsers and has different problems and different limitations in different browsers. And with the torrent protocol, like one of the things you need to do is like you need to basically have access to the file data at all times, because a peer could ask you for any part of it. They could show up and say, hey, I need this piece of the file, and you have to be able to return that to them for the protocol to work. And so that what that means is that, you know, the sender doesn't just encrypt the file data and then upload it to the cloud and then they're done. That stream that I mentioned, that pipeline at the beginning, where we take the file data, we feed it through an encryption stream, and then we feed the result through a stream that produces a torrent file. We actually have to do that in parallel with that data that's coming out of that stream. That encrypted file data has to be used to both to produce a torrent file, but then also that needs to be uploaded to Backblaze at the same time. And so that complicates a little bit how you consume that stream, because you kind of have to consume it at the same rate, like writing it into the storage and uploading it to Backblaze at the same rate. Or else you get back pressure that sort of stops the stream because one of the writer, like one of the sinks, is basically too slow. So that's one problem. And then, like I mentioned, the storage is the biggest problem. So that means now you also have to take the whole file, all the files that are already on your hard drive somewhere, and you have to store them again in like the browser storage, which is kind of wasteful. But you have to do that because you can't assume that you're going to have like a handle to the files forever. The user could move them, or the user could delete them, or the user could refresh their browser tab, and then now your reference to the files is gone. So we store them into browser storage, and there's just all kinds of limitations with that. Like Firefox caps you to 2 gigs and only supports IndexedDB, which is not the best API. And Safari has a buggy IndexedDB implementation and gives you unlimited space, but they force you to ask the user for confirmation after 1 gigabyte of storage. So after 1 gig, it'll say, hey, do you want to let this site store 1.2 gigs? And then if they say yes, then you get like another 200 megs. And then once you get to 1.4 gigs, it says, hey, do you want to let the site store 1.4? So it just keeps asking them 1.4, 1.6, 1.8, 2.0. And so if you're trying to do like, send a 5 gig file, it's just completely unacceptable. You just get like, 30 prompts or something like that. It's ridiculous. So you can't actually do that. So you end up having to support a memory store, which just means you're using up a bunch of RAM, which is not good. So yeah, we basically have to decide like depending on the user's hard drive's situation, like how much free space they have, because that also can affect it. Plus the browser they're using, we have to have this like heuristic for like deciding, do we want to try to rely on disk space, or do we want to like go with the all memory strategy? And then yeah, like on the downloader side, sometimes we're just like, okay, you're on iOS, like you have a really constrained browser, you're using Safari on iOS, so we're not even going to try to store it. We're just going to put you into like what we call storage free mode, which means that we just straight up download the files from Backblaze, and we don't even try to connect to peers or do the torrent protocol at all, because we just know that like we're not going to have enough space where we can do like, you know, where we can write the bits of the file that we're getting from each of the peers into the right part of the file, you know, in that storage system. What we have to do instead is just basically trick the browser into thinking this is just a normal file download that it can just fetch sequentially and put into your downloads folder. And we use the service worker to do that. So the browser thinks it's just a normal file download, but it's actually it's coming from Backblaze, and we're decrypting it on the fly and then feeding it to the HTTP response through the service worker. And then that gets downloaded into the user's downloads folder. So anyway, you can see, like, it's just a huge rabbit hole of like, oh, you know, this browser sucks in this way, and this browser is, you know, whatever. And then you just kind of are constantly just deciding like what like compromises to make it work well everywhere. And it's just, it's a huge trade-off. Like, maybe we should have just said, you know, like cloud only, and then we don't have to deal with any of this storage nonsense.
Huh, that's fascinating. I will say I would have expected this project coming from you to have been peer-to-peer only.
Yeah, well, there already is instant.io, which is like the pure kind of WebTorrent peer-to-peer only site. Yeah. It just doesn't have end-to-end encryption because it's meant as more of like a hello world for WebTorrent. So we probably will offer a peer-to-peer only mode. In fact, it's on our roadmap. So we'll have a mode that just says like, you know, no cloud, for the truly paranoid who don't even want even the encrypted files to end up in the cloud. Like, we'll offer that just because it'll make people happy. But I almost feel like there's room for like another option, which is like no peer-to-peer, because I want it to work more reliably and not deal with all the storage stuff. Although, the end user doesn't even know that, like, that's too much complexity to expose to an end user, but like that's kind of what I secretly want, is like no storage system in the browser, because it's super annoying.
Yeah, it's one of those, it's amazingly complicated to build something really simple that just the number of those gates you have to go through.
Shout out to the file system access API, by the way. That's the new API in Chrome and Edge for dealing with the file system, and it is really good. It is a great API.
Does that solve the problems you were alluding to before about needing to keep track of those file pointers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it gives you, it's actually a bunch of interesting things in one API. So the things that we particularly like about it for the wormhole use case is, one is you can ask for a ton more space than you can get with the other stuff. So you can say like, give me, I think the maximum space you can use is like 20% of the user's free space on their hard drive. And what's cool is this is done in a temporary way. So the browser knows that this is like data that it can delete if you're running low on space, or if, you know, if you suddenly start using a lot more space on your hard drive, and now suddenly the site is using more than 20% of the free space, then it'll clear it. So it's explicitly marked as temporary space. So there's no guarantee it's going to stick around, but that's actually fine for what we're doing with Wormhole. We're just using it as like a holding area for the data that we're working with. And then once you download it truly to your downloads folder, then it's like, now it's truly safe. And then, you know, it doesn't really matter what happens to this like temporary storage thing we were using in the browser. So that's really nice. And there's no prompt for it because it's just temporary and it's just free space. So they're just like, whatever, use it. And then we can clear it at any time. So I really like that model. If we could ask for the same thing from Safari or Firefox, that would fix all of our problems. Because see, with Firefox and Safari, we're using IndexedDB, which the contract there is that the browser is not allowed to clear that. So it's considered like the same as like a cookie or something. It's like you only clear that when the user explicitly asks you to clear the site data. Otherwise, it could contain important stuff that you wouldn't want to just clear for no reason. And so for that reason, they have to like restrict the amount of space that they're giving you. And also then it's on us to remember to clear it. So we have a bunch more code that's like, when you come to Wormhole and you're trying to do a share, we have a manifest where we keep track of all the things we've stored on your machine. And we can say like, okay, this set of files has already expired. So there's no use to even keeping them on your computer because the server itself has like already deleted its copy and it's deleted all the metadata about it. So there's no way this data is ever going to be used. So we clear everything after, you know, after 24 hours or the whenever the room expires. And we also clear it proactively when there's not enough space. So like if you have data for an old link that you visited that's still being kept around because it's 24 hours isn't up yet and it might come in handy for later, you know, we'll delete that to make room for the file you're currently dealing with. So there's all this like code for that that we have to do that we don't have to worry about with a temporary file system, because there we can just use as much as we want and rely on the browser to clear it if we're out of space. So that's really nice. And then the other thing it's really good at is it gives you a file type interface instead of a database. So it's perfectly suited for what we're doing. We just want to store chunks of files and we want that to be fast, and we don't want like transactions and queries and indexes and all this other stuff that IndexedDB gives you that just slows us down. Yeah, there's even more things that it can do, but we're not really using that stuff yet. One of the coolest things the File System Access API can do is it'll let you actually use real files on the user's machine. So you can build stuff like, you know, like a photo editor on the web now, and you can open up a file that's on your computer and edit it. Like you can edit a JPEG or something and then click like save on the website, and it can write over that file that you opened just like a normal program on your computer would. And this is great because like before this API, you had to download it again to your downloads folder. There was no way for the site to kind of overwrite a file that you already had on your computer. So it means that the web just, it gets a lot more powerful with this API.
Yeah, no, I've been pretty excited about it also.
But. Yeah, it's great.
All right, so have you learned anything from building this thus far that you'll use going forward? Any important lessons?
I guess don't underestimate how much technical complexity will come out of nowhere for certain decisions that seem trivial, you know? That's one thing.
Yeah. Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. There's probably other lessons too. I mean, I think one thing that's worked really well is constantly talking about the features that we're building on Twitter and getting feedback from people and sharing the progress. So we have a public roadmap on the website that's pretty nice, that lets people know what we're working on, and we have a Discord server where people come and talk to us, and that's all been really nice. And translations. We asked people to help us translate the website, and we got like an overwhelming response in like just a few days. We had like the whole site translated into like 20 plus languages, and that was really awesome. I'm definitely gonna ask people for help in the future if I have a site that has a lot of international visitors who are already using it in English and are like, you know, wishing that it was in their language. Like that worked out so well. We just used Crowdin to organize the translations, and then which is not free, by the way, it's actually kind of expensive. We used, you know, some internationalization library in React. I think it's called i18 Next. But yeah, it was a new experience for me. I've never gone through that before, but it actually worked out pretty well. And there's now all these like super engaged community members that are like on the Discord who all have like special translator status, and like, you know, get like a special color in the chat and like are always like ready to translate new strings that we add to the code base. So yeah, I just found that really cool. 'Cause like, I wouldn't have guessed that people would love the product that much to like want to like just, you know, eagerly like translate new strings that we add like within a couple of hours of us adding them. And but yeah, that's actually what some people just really love it.
So I won't ask you what's next for Wormhole, because I'll point folks to the roadmap. But do you know what's next for you? Do you have other projects in the works, or are you staying on this train?
Yeah, I'm staying on this train, working on Wormhole. We're gonna make it the best way to send files. We have a bunch of stuff to do still. So yeah, I mean, we want to make it even more secure if we can. Like one thing that we want to work on is it's not on the roadmap, so I can tell you this is secret info.
you can say anything that is on the roadmap. I'm just using up a lot of your time.
No, it's all good. The thing that I'm personally really interested in is how to give people even more assurances about the security of the app. And so like one thing we're probably going to do is get a security audit soon with like a professional security auditor. We should do some kind of like offline sort of native app type thing so that you don't have to rely on the website serving you the correct JavaScript every time you visit. And, you know, Wormhole is end-to-end encrypted, but like one kind of downside with using web technologies for end-to-end encryption is that, especially if, you know, if it's just a website, is that you do have to trust that the code that's actually doing the encryption scheme is being sent to you by our server. If that JavaScript file is compromised in some way, then the end-to-end encryption doesn't really work. So this is like, it's not that different than like how native apps work. I mean, technically you have the same problem even there, because not a lot of native apps have auto updaters built into them now. And so what that means is that, again, if the server is compromised, they can auto update you. And now suddenly the code that's doing your encryption is just not doing, you know, could not be doing it correctly anymore. So this is a problem with really any app where the sort of server can be compromised and then suddenly just deliver new code to all the endpoints. But the web makes this problem like a little bit worse, because the code is sort of potentially could be different just on every page load versus on auto updaters typically run less often than on every time you open the app. Though there's nothing stopping them from running more often. So that's something that I kind of would love if there was a way just to fix this in the web platform itself. But I feel like we need new web standards to enable this. We need basically some way for a site to kind of like fix itself to a specific set of code, and then for updates to that code to be controlled by the user. So the user can sort of accept or, you know, reject updates, this needs to be mediated by the browser, I think, in order for it to actually be secure. And this is just not a thing that a lot of websites are asking for, so I don't think this is like going to be a priority for the browser vendors, but it would sort of be useful for a lot of this kind of security sensitive stuff that takes place on the web, like Bitcoin wallet. Like, you could imagine even having a Bitcoin wallet on the web. If you trust on first use, you know, you download the code, you offline it forever, and then you only accept updates when you choose to. And so that means that like you could have the hash displayed to the user, and you could go and check to see that like the community says that this version is good, or I could audit the code myself, and then if I confirm that it looks good, then I can decide to update. And you can enable all these more sort of paranoid behaviors,
avoid the event stream fiasco.
Yeah, exactly. So this would probably only be used by a few users, but it's the kind of thing that like those few users will provide almost like a herd immunity for everybody. Like if there's a few users checking every change and like, you know, really auditing the code, it could help even the people who aren't doing it. But right now the way it works is it's just like every visitor that comes to the site gets different code. And, you know, even though we're going to do our best to do everything well, there's just a segment of users that want even more security. So we'd love to like keep improving it in that way if we can.
Oh, wonderful. And so one of the last things that I always ask my guests is, what are some other projects that you love?
Well, we've talked a lot about like really low level protocol stuff and browser technologies, a lot. So I'll switch things up and I'll talk about something that's completely different level, of the stack. I'll recommend this library called Chakra UI, which is a set of React components. I recommend it because I have very high standards for what a component library should do, and everything I've used has always been disappointing in some way, but this is the first thing I've found that actually I don't really have any problems with. It's just everything looks nice by default. It doesn't look like very clearly associated with one company like Material Design does. Everything is accessible. Everything it just feels light and looks nice, and it has so many like smart decisions in its design that I get too many to even go into here, but it just really makes doing UI a joy. So it's been kind of a game changer for me. So if you're using React in your app, I would look at that as a, if you're building something and you want to not have to invent all the components from scratch, then Chakra is a good starting point, I think. I don't know. Maybe I can shout out something else too. I really like the stuff that Paul Frazee's doing. This is a more lower level thing, but he's working on hypercore stuff, he was building a social app for a while. And before that he worked on Beaker Browser, which is a really cool project that I'm kind of sad that he's not working on anymore. I always like whatever Paul does. He's always doing cool stuff. So follow him, P Frazee on Twitter. That's who I'll shout out.
All right. Well, great. So I think that brings us to the end of the episode. Is there anything else of yours that you'd like to promote?
I'm working on Wormhole as a, you know, as a company. So there's a company that's behind it that I started called Socket. So if you're interested in checking that out, you can find out more at socket.dev. And we are hiring. So if you think that Wormhole is interesting and you want to work on security and privacy stuff for the web, definitely hit me up.
All right. And how can people find you on the internet?
I'm just Feroz on Twitter, Feroz on GitHub. Feroz@feroz.org is my email. Feroz.org is my website. Yeah, I got all the Feroz handles. It's Feross. That's the, one of the advantages of having a strange name that has a unique spelling.
All right. Well, thank you again for all of your time. Links to the projects mentioned will be in the show notes. Have a wonderful day.
Cool. Thanks, Raphael.
Well, that wraps it up for this week on The Runtime. I remain your host, Raphael Kennedy. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe and, if possible, leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice. It really helps to spread the word. If you have thoughts, feedback, or ideas of folks that I should interview for the show, please reach out either via email at raphael@runtimepodcast.com or on Twitter @podcastruntime. Thanks again for listening.